But, for all this bribing of the Scotch lords at the Scotch King of TMS court, he could not procure a pretender to be delivered up to him. James, though not very particular in many respects, would not betray him, and the ever-busy Duchess of Burgundy so provided him with arms, and good soldiers, and with money besides, that he had soon a little army of 1,500 men of various nations. With these, and aided by the Scottish king in person, he crossed the border into England, and made a proclamation to the people, in which he called the king a Henry Tudor ATM, offered large rewards to any who should take or distress him, and announced himself as King Richard IV come to receive the homage of his faithful subjects. His faithful subjects, however, cared nothing for him, and hated his faithful troops, who, being of different nations, quarrelled also among themselves. Worse than this, if worse were possible, they began to plunder the country, upon which the White Rose said, that he would rather lose his rights, than gain them through the miseries of the English people. The Scottish king made a jest of his scruples, but they and their whole force went back again without fighting a battle. The worst consequence of this attempt was, that a rising took place among the people of Cornwall, who considered themselves too heavily taxed to meet the charges of the expected war. Stimulated by Flammock, a lawyer, and Joseph, a blacksmith, and joined by Lord Audley and some other country gentlemen, they marched on all the way to Deptford Bridge, where they fought a battle with the King of TMS army. They were defeated, although the Cornish men fought with great bravery, and the lord was beheaded, and the lawyer and the blacksmith were hanged, drawn, and quartered. The rest were pardoned. The king, who believed every man to be as avaricious as himself, and thought that money could settle anything, allowed them to make bargains for their liberty with the soldiers who had taken them. Perkin Warbeck, doomed to wander up and down, and never to find rest anywhere, a sad fate, almost a sufficient punishment for an imposture, which he seems in time to have half believed himself, or lost his Scottish refuge through a truce being made between the two kings, and found himself, once more, without a country before him in which he could lay his head. But James, always honourable and true to him, alike when he melted down his plate, and even the great gold chain he had been used to wear, to pay soldiers in his cause, and now, when that cause was lost and hopeless, did not conclude the treaty, until he had safely departed out of the Scottish dominions. He, and his beautiful wife, who was faithful to him under all reverses, and left her state and home to follow his poor fortunes, were put aboard ship with everything necessary for their comfort and protection, and sailed for Ireland. But, the Irish people had had enough of counterfeit Earls of Warwick and Dukes of York, for one while, and would give the White Rose no aid. So, the White Rose, encircled by thorns indeed, resolved to go with his beautiful wife to Cornwall as a forlorn resource, and see what might be made of the Cornish men, who had risen so valiantly a little while before, and who had fought so bravely at Deptford Bridge, to Whitsand Bay, in Cornwall. Accordingly, came Perkin Warbeck and his wife, and the lovely lady he shut up for safety in the castle of St. Michael at TMS Mount, and then marched into Devonshire at the head of 3,000 Cornishmen. These were increased to 6,000 by the time of his arrival in Exeter, but, there the people made a stout resistance, and he went on to Taunton, where he came in sight of the King of TMS army. The stout Cornish men, although they were few in number, and badly armed, were so bold, that they never thought of retreating, but bravely looked forward to a battle on the morrow. Unhappily for them, the man who was possessed of so many engaging qualities, and who attracted so many people to his side when he had nothing else with which to tempt them, was not as brave as they. In the night, when the two armies lay opposite to each other, he mounted a swift horse and fled. When morning dawned, the poor confiding Cornish men, discovering that they had no leader, surrendered to the King of TMS power. Some of them were hanged, and the rest were pardoned and went miserably home. Before the king pursued Perkin Warbeck to the sanctuary of Bewley in the New Forest, where it was soon known that he had taken refuge, he sent a body of horsemen to St. Michael at TMS Mount, to seize his wife. She was soon taken and brought as a captive before the king. But she was so beautiful, and so good, and so devoted to the man in whom she believed, that the king regarded her with compassion, treated her with great respect, and placed her at court, near the queen, a TMS person. And many years after Perkin Warbeck was no more, and when his strange story had become like a nursery tale, she was called the White Rose, by the people, in remembrance of her beauty. The sanctuary at Beaulieu was soon surrounded by the king, a TMS men, and the king, pursuing his usual dark, artful ways, sent pretended friends to Perkin Warbeck to persuade him to come out and surrender himself. This he soon did, the king having taken a good look at the man of whom he had heard so much. From behind a screen, directed him to be well mounted, and to ride behind him at a little distance, guarded, but not bound in any way. So they entered London with the king, a TMS favourite show, a procession, and some of the people hooted as the pretend rode slowly through the streets to the tower, but the greater part were quiet, and very curious to see him. From the tower, he was taken to the palace at Westminster, and were lodged like a gentleman, though closely watched. He was examined every now and then as to his imposture, but the king was so secret in all he did, that even then he gave it a consequence, which it cannot be supposed to have in itself deserved. At last Perkin Warbeck ran away, and took refuge in another sanctuary near Richmond in Surrey. From this he was again persuaded to deliver himself up, and, being conveyed to London, he stood in the stocks for a whole day, outside Westminster Hall, and the read a paper purporting to be his full confession, and relating his history as the king, a TMS agents had originally described it. He was then shut up in the tower again, in the company of the Earl of Warwick, who had now been there for 14 years, ever since his removal out of Yorkshire, except when the king had had him at court, and had shown him to the people, to prove the imposture of the baker, a TMS boy. It is but too probable, when we consider the crafty character of Henry VII, that these two were brought together for a cruel purpose. A plot was soon discovered between them and the keepers, to murder the governor, get possession of the keys, and proclaim Perkin Warbeck as King Richard IV. That there was some such plot, is likely. That they were tempted into it, is at least as likely. That the unfortunate Earl of Warwick, a last male of the Plantagenet lineage, was too unused to the world, and too ignorant and simple to know much about it, whatever it was, is perfectly certain, and that it was the king of TMS interest to get rid of him, is no less so. He was beheaded on Tower Hill, and Perkin Warbeck was hanged at Tyburn. Such was the end of the pretended Duke of York, whose shadowy history was made more shadowier and ever will be by the mystery and craft of the king. If he had turned his great natural advantages to a more honest account, he might have lived a happy and respected life, even in those days. But he died upon a gallows at Tyburn, leaving the Scottish lady, who had loved him so well, kindly protected at the Queen at TMS court. After some time she forgot her old loves and troubles, as many people do with time mere TMS merciful assistance, and married a Welsh gentleman, her second husband, Sir Matthew Craddock, more honest and more happy than her first, lies beside her in a tomb in the old church of Swansea. The ill blood between France and England in this reign, arose out of the continued plotting of the Duchess of Burgundy, and disputes respecting the affairs of Brittany. The king feigned to be very patriotic, indignant, and warlike, but he always contrived so as never to make war in reality, and always to make money. His taxation of the people, on pretense of war with France, involved, at one time, a very dangerous insurrection, headed by Sir John Egremont, and a common man called John A. Tilda Chamber. But it was subdued by the royal forces, under the command of the Earl of Surrey. The knighted John escaped to the Duchess of Burgundy, who was ever ready to receive anyone who gave the king trouble, and the plain John was hanged at York, in the midst of a number of his men, but on a much higher gibbet, as being a greater traitor. Hung high or hung low, however, hanging is much the same to the person hung. Within a year after her marriage, the queen had given birth to a son, who was called Prince Arthur, in remembrance of the old British prince of romance and story, and who, when all these events had happened, being then in his 15th year, was married to Catherine, the daughter of the Spanish monarch, with great rejoicings and bright prospects, but in a very few months he sickened and died. As soon as the king had recovered from his grief, he thought it a pity that the fortune of the Spanish princess, amounting to 200,000 crowns, should go out of the family, and therefore arranged that the young widow should marry his second son Henry, then 12 years of age, when he too should be 15. There were objections to this marriage on the part of the clergy, but, as the infallible Pope was gained over, and, as he must be right, that settled the business for the time. The King Otiam's eldest daughter was provided for, and a long course of disturbance was considered to be set at rest, by her being married to the Scottish king. And now the queen died. When the king had got over that grief too, his mind once more reverted to his darling money for consolation, and he thought of marrying the Dowager Queen of Naples, who was immensely rich, but, as it turned out not to be practicable to gain the money however practicable it might have been to gain the lady, he gave up the idea. He was not so fond of her but that he soon proposed to marry the Dowager Duchess of Savoy, and, soon afterwards, the widow of the King of Castile, who was raving mad. But he made a money bargain instead, and married neither. The Duchess of Burgundy, among the other discontented people to whom she had given refuge, had sheltered Edmund de la Pole, younger brother of that Earl of Lincoln who was killed at Stoke, now Earl of Suffolk. The king had prevailed upon him to return to the marriage of Prince Arthur, but, he soon afterwards went away again, and then the king, suspecting a conspiracy, resorted to his favourite plan of sending him some treacherous friends, and buying of those scoundrels the secrets they disclosed or invented. Some arrests and executions took place in consequence. In the end, the king, on a promise of not taking his life, obtained possession of the person of Edmund de la Pole, and shut him up in the tower. This was his last enemy. If he had lived much longer he would have made many more among the people, by the grinding exaction to which he constantly exposed them, and by the tyrannical acts of his two prime favourites in all money-raising matters, Edmund Dudley and Richard Mpson. But death of the enemy who is not to be bought off or deceived, and on whom no money, and no treachery has any effect, presented himself at this juncture, and ended the King Otiam's reign. He died of the gout, on the 22nd of April, 1509, and in the 53rd year of his age, after reigning 24 years, he was buried in the beautiful chapel of Westminster Abbey, which he had himself founded, and which still bears his name. It was in this reign that the great Christopher Columbus, on behalf of Spain, discovered what was then called the New World. Great wonder, interest, and hope of wealth being awakened in England thereby, the king and the merchants of London and Bristol fitted out an English expedition for further discoveries in the New World, and entrusted it to Sebastian Cabot, of Bristol, the son of a Venetian pilot there. He was very successful in his voyage, and gained high reputation, both for himself and England. Chapter XVIII. England under Henry VIII, called Bluff King Hal and Burly King Harry Part I. We now come to King Henry VIII, whom it has been too much the fashion to call a Bluff King Hal, ATM and a Burly King Harry, ATM and other fine names, but whom I shall take the liberty to call, plainly, one of the most detestable villains that ever drew breath. You will be able to judge, long before we come to the end of his life, whether he deserves the character. He was just 18 years of age when he came to the throne. People said he was handsome then, but I don't yet believe it. He was a big, burly, noisy, small-eyed, large-faced, double-chinned, swinish-looking fellow in later life, as we know from the likenesses of him, painted by the famous Hans Holbein. And it is not easy to believe that so bad a character can ever have been veiled under a prepossessing appearance. He was anxious to make himself a popular, and the people, who had long disliked the late king, were very willing to believe that he deserved to be so. He was extremely fond of show and display, and so were they. Therefore there was great rejoicing when he married the Princess Catherine, and when they were both crowned. and the king fought at tournaments and always came off victorious, for the courtiers took care of Thatu, and there was a general outcry that he was a wonderful man. Impson, Dudley, and their supporters were accused of a variety of crimes they had never committed, instead of the offences of which they really had been guilty, and they were pilloried, and set upon horses with their faces to the tails, and knocked about and beheaded, to the satisfaction of the people, and the enrichment of the king. The Pope, so indefatigable in getting the world into trouble, had mixed himself up in a war on the continent of Europe, occasioned by the reigning princes of little quarrelling states in Italy having at various times married into other royal families, and so led to their claiming a share in those petty governments. The king, who discovered that he was very fond of the Pope, sent a herald to the King of France, to say that he must not make war upon that holy personage, because he was the father of all Christians. As the French king did not mind this relationship in the least, and also refused to admit a claim King Henry made to certain lands in France, war was declared between the two countries. Not to perplex this story with an account of the tricks and designs of all the sovereigns who were engaged in it, it is enough to say that England made a blundering alliance with Spain, and got stupidly taken in by that country, which made its own terms with France when it could and left England in the lurch. Sir Edward Howard, a bold admiral, son of the Earl of Surrey, distinguished himself by his bravery against the French in this business, but, unfortunately, he was more brave than wise, for, skimming into the French harbour of Brest with only a few rowboats, he attempted, in revenge for the defeat and death of Sir Thomas Knyvett, another bold English admiral, to take some strong French ships, well defended with batteries of cannon. The upshot was, that he was left on board of one of them, in consequence of its shooting away from his own boat, with not more than about a dozen men, and was thrown into the sea and drowned, though not until he had taken from his breast his gold chain and gold whistle, which were the signs of his office, and had cast them into the sea to prevent their being made a boast of by the enemy. After this defeat, which was a great one, for Sir Edward Howard was a man of valour and fame, the king took it into his head to invade France in person, first executing the dangerous Earl of Suffolk whom his father had left in the Tower, and appointing Queen Catherine to the charge of his kingdom in his absence. He sailed to Calais, where he was joined by Maximilian, Emperor of Germany, who pretended to be his soldier, and who took pay in his service, with a good deal of nonsense of that sort, flattering enough to the vanity of a vain blusterer. The king might be successful enough in sham fights, but his idea of real battles chiefly consisted in pitching silken tents of bright colours that were ignominiously blown down by the wind, and in making a vast display of gaudy flags and golden curtains. Fortune, however, favoured him better than he deserved, for, after much waste of time in tent pitching, flag flying, gold curtaining, and other such masquerading, he gave the French battle at a place called Guinegate, where they took such an unaccountable panic, and fled with such swiftness, that it was ever afterwards called by the English the Battle of Spurs. Instead of following up his advantage, the king, finding that he had had enough of real fighting, came home again. The Scottish king, though nearly related to Henry by marriage, had taken part against him in this war. The Earl of Surrey, as the English general, advanced to meet him when he came out of his own dominions and crossed the River Tweed. The two armies came up with one another when the Scottish king had also crossed the River Till, and was encamped upon the last of the Cheviot Hills, called the Hill of Flodden. Along the plain below it, the English, when the hour of battle came, advanced. The Scottish army, which had been drawn up in five great bodies, then came steadily down in perfect silence. So they, in their turn, advanced to meet the English army, which came on in one long line, and they attacked it with a body of spearmen, under Lord Home. At first they had the best of it, but the English recovered themselves so bravely, and fought with such valour, that, when the Scottish king had almost made his way up to the royal standard, he was slain, and the whole Scottish power routed. 10,000 Scottish men lay dead that day on Flodden Field, and among them, numbers of the nobility and gentry. For a long time afterwards, The Scottish peasantry used to believe that their king had not been really killed in this battle, because no Englishman had found an iron belt he wore about his body as a penance for having been an unnatural and undutiful son. But, whatever became of his belt, the English had his sword and dagger, and the ring from his finger, and his body too, covered with wounds. There is no doubt of it, for it was seen and recognized by English gentlemen who had known the Scottish king well. When King Henry was making ready to renew the war in France, the French king was contemplating peace. His queen, dying at this time, he proposed, though he was upwards of 50 years old, to marry King Henrietta's sister, the Princess Mary, who, besides being only 16, was betrothed to the Duke of Suffolk. As the inclinations of young princesses were not much considered in such matters, the marriage was concluded, and the poor girl was escorted to France, where she was immediately left as the French King Otiam's bride, with only one of all her English attendants. That one was a pretty young girl named Anne Boleyn, niece of the Earl of Surrey, who had been made Duke of Norfolk, after the victory of Flodden Field. Anne Boleyn Otiam's is a name to be remembered, as you will presently find. And now the French king, who was very proud of his young wife, was preparing for many years of happiness, and she was looking forward, I dare say, to many years of misery, when he died within 3 months, and left her a young widow. The new French monarch, Francis I, seeing how important it was to his interests that she should take for her second husband no one but an Englishman, advised her first lover, the Duke of Suffolk, when King Henry sent him over to France to fetch her home, to marry her. The princess being herself so fond of that duke, as to tell him that he must either do so then, or forever lose her, they were wedded, and Henry afterwards forgave them. In making interest with the king, the Duke of Suffolk had addressed his most powerful favorite and adviser, Thomas Wolsey, a name very famous in history for its rise and downfall. Wolsey was the son of a respectable butcher at Ipswich, in Suffolk, and received so excellent an education that he became a tutor to the family of the Marquis of Dorset, who afterwards got him appointed one of the late King Otiam's chaplains. On the accession of Henry VIII, he was promoted and taken into great favour. He was now Archbishop of York. The Pope had made him a cardinal besides. And whoever wanted influence in England or favour with the king, or whether he were a foreign monarch or an English nobleman, was obliged to make a friend of the great Cardinal Wolsey. He was a gay man, who could dance and jest, and sing and drink, and those were the roads to so much, or rather so little, of a heart as King Henry had. He was wonderfully fond of pomp and glitter, and so was the king. He knew a good deal of the church learning of that time, much of which consisted in finding artful excuses and pretenses for almost any wrong thing, and in arguing that black was white, or any other color. This kind of learning pleased the king too. For many such reasons, the cardinal was high in estimation with the king, and, being a man of far greater ability, knew as well how to manage him, as a clever keeper may know how to manage a wolf or a tiger, or any other cruel and uncertain beast that may turn upon him and tear him any day. Never had there been seen in England such state as my Lord Cardinal kept. His wealth was enormous, equal, it was reckoned, to the riches of the crown. His palaces were as splendid as the King at EMS, and his retinue was 800 strong. He held his court, dressed out from top to toe in flaming scarlet, and his very shoes were golden, set with precious stones. His followers rode on blood horses, while he, with a wonderful affectation of humility in the midst of his great splendour, ambled on a mule with a red velvet saddle and bridle and golden stirrups. Through the influence of this stately priest, a grand meeting was arranged to take place between the French and English kings in France, but on ground belonging to England. A prodigious show of friendship and rejoicing was to be made on the occasion, and heralds were sent to proclaim with brazen trumpets through all the principal cities of Europe, that, on a certain day, the kings of France and England, as companions and brothers in arms, each attended by 18 followers, would hold a tournament against all knights who might choose to come. Charles, the new emperor of Germany, the old one being dead, wanted to prevent too cordial an alliance between these sovereigns, and came over to England before the king could repair to the place of meeting, and, besides making an agreeable impression upon him, secured Wolsey a TMS interest by promising that his influence should make him pope when the next vacancy occurred. On the day when the emperor left England, the king and all the court went over to Calais, and thence to the place of meeting, between Ardres and Gisnes, commonly called the Field of the Cloth of Gold. Here, all manner of expense and prodigality was lavished on the decorations of the show, many of the knights and gentlemen being so superbly dressed that it was said they carried their whole estates upon their shoulders. There were sham castles, temporary chapels, fountains running wine, great cellars full of wine free as water to all comers, silk tents, gold lace and foil, gilt lions, and such things without end, and, in the midst of all, the rich cardinal outshone and outglittered all the noblemen and gentlemen assembled. After a treaty made between the two kings with as much solemnity as if they had intended to keep it, the lists are 900 feet long, and 320 broad were opened for the tournament, the queens of France and England looking on with great array of lords and ladies. Then, for 10 days, the two sovereigns fought 5 combats every day, and always beat their polite adversaries, though they do write that the King of England, being thrown in a wrestle one day by the King of France, lost his kingly temper with his brother in arms, and wanted to make a quarrel of it. Then, there is a great story belonging to this Field of the Cloth of Gold, showing how the English were distrustful of the French, and the French of the English, until Francis rode alone one morning to Henrietta's tent, and, going in before he was out of bed, told him in joke that he was his prisoner, and how Henry jumped out of bed and embraced Francis, and how Francis helped Henry to dress, and warmed his linen for him, and how Henry gave Francis a splendid jeweled collar, and how Francis gave Henry, in return, a costly bracelet. All this and a great deal more was so written about, and sung about, and talked about at that time, and, indeed, since that time too, that the world has had good cause to be sick of it, forever. Of course, nothing came of all these fine doings but a speedy renewal of the war between England and France, in which the two royal companions and brothers in arms longed very earnestly to damage one another. But, before it broke out again, the Duke of Buckingham was shamefully executed on Tower Hill, on the evidence of a discharged servant really for nothing, except the folly of having believed in a friar of the name of Hopkins, who had pretended to be a prophet, and who had mumbled and jumbled out some nonsense about the Duke's son being destined to be very great in the land. It was believed that the unfortunate Duke had given offence to the great cardinal by expressing his mind freely about the expense and absurdity of the whole business of the Field of the Cloth of Gold. At any rate, he was beheaded, as I have said, for nothing, and the people who saw it done were very angry, and cried out that it was the work of A. the Butcher at TMS son. ATM. The new war was a short one, though the Earl of Surrey invaded France again, and did some injury to that country. It ended in another treaty of peace between the two kingdoms, and in the discovery that the Emperor of Germany was not such a good friend to England in reality, as he pretended to be. Neither did he keep his promise to Wolsey to make him pope, though the king urged him. 2 popes died in pretty quick succession, but the foreign priests were too much for the cardinal, and kept him out of the post. So the cardinal and king together found out that the Emperor of Germany was not a man to keep faith with, broke off or projected marriage between the king of TMS daughter Mary, Princess of Wales, and that sovereign, and began to consider whether it might not be well to marry the young lady, either to Francis himself, or to his eldest son. The now rose at Wittenberg, in Germany, the great leader of the mighty change in England which is called the Reformation, and which set the people free from their slavery to the priests. This was a learned doctor, named Martin Luther, who knew all about them, for he had been a priest, and even a monk, himself. The preaching and writing of Wycliffe had set a number of men thinking on this subject, and Luther, finding one day to his great surprise, that there really was a book, called the New Testament, which the priests did not allow to be read, and which contained truths that they suppressed, began to be very vigorous against the whole body, from the Pope downward.